Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals. Family and domestic violence is not only a private or personal issue. It impacts on and affects an individual's and their family's life in all facets, including at work. We know that when an employee is living with family and domestic violence, they can be experiencing heightened financial stress, sometimes homelessness, isolation, certainly vulnerability, and quite often shame. This is a matter that has many and varied implications for employers who have a fundamental role to play in supporting survivors by understanding and being aware of their obligations through planning and implementing ways to support employees and to create a safe workplace. There are obligations on employers in relation to providing leave and other assistance, including those who may be experiencing or perpetrating family violence. I'm Krista Leonard, partner at Kingston Reid, and today I'm joined by Erica Elliott, special counsel in our work health safety team. Hello, Erica.
Hello, everyone.
And we have the privilege of being joined by Regan Mitchell from Weave Youth and Community Services, a not-for-profit organisation operating here in Sydney. Regan is one of the domestic violence caseworkers at Weave. Regan, welcome to our podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Erica, it's hardly controversial, but tell us why family and domestic violence is a workplace issue.
Well, it's a workplace issue because people who conduct a business or undertaking, which in the safety space we refer to as PCBUs, have got statutory obligations that require them to take reasonably practical steps to ensure the safety of both their workplaces and their workers whilst those people are carrying out work for the relevant business, department or agency. Now, given those duties, the obligation to ensure worker safety, as far as it's reasonably practical, doesn't just start and stop when workers enter and exit the physical boundaries of the workplace, nor does an employer's potential workers' compensation exposure depend on traditional office or construction site or other work site placements.
And of course, it's an industrial issue because we now see the insertion of family and domestic violence leave into awards and enterprise agreements and the like. So, Regan, it's trite to say that the past 9 months have been a highly stressful period for pretty much everyone. Can you elaborate on the factors that you've seen impacting your clients during COVID and your observations in relation to there being an increase in the level of domestic and family violence?
Yeah, sure, Krista. First, I just wanted to acknowledge that men also experience domestic violence. However, we know that the prevalence is significantly higher for women. And within my role in the program I work in at Weave, we specifically support women and children experiencing domestic and family violence and abuse. And that's what I'll be talking about today. But yeah, we've definitely seen various factors contributing to an increase in both the prevalence and severity of domestic and family violence. In particular, we've been told by police that there's been a noticeable increase in the severity of physical assaults. During COVID, women experiencing DV have been forced to spend more time with their perpetrator, with working from home and increased socialisation, isolation and decreased social movement. We know that there's been an increase of alcohol consumption and online gambling and decreased outlets such as going to the pub, seeing mates, playing and attending sport. You know, the stresses of kids home from school and childcare and homeschooling. People have been living in a pressure cooker environment where there's been no escape from the perpetrator when they usually would leave the house to go to work or pick up the kids, have contact with friends or family. And also, due to the COVID restrictions on court appearances, there's been a backlog of cases waiting to be heard. And this has resulted in fewer perpetrators being convicted and incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Additionally, some domestic violence perpetrators have actually been released from jail earlier due to the need to reduce numbers of offenders in jails due to COVID. As a service at Weave, we have experienced a tripling of requests for home lock changes and a clear increase in referrals for home security upgrades. And although we have really strict geographical boundaries for the women we support, we've had to extend our reach beyond those boundaries during COVID in order to support more women to be safe.
So I guess it's within that context then that many employers who have required their employees during the COVID period over the last couple of months to work remotely have had to consider their obligations and how to manage those issues that you've just described without necessarily having the bandwidth or the know-how and how to do it. Erica, can you explain a bit further about how far the work health and safety obligations regarding workers and workplaces extends? When is it and is it not an employer's responsibility to manage?
It's a very broad duty, and that's for two reasons. The first one is because the duty to manage worker safety applies to all times when employees, contractors, and subcontractors are carrying out work for an employer. And the second is that the statutory definition of a workplace includes anywhere that a worker goes or is even likely to go while they're doing work. Now, that means that home workplaces are every bit as much subject to work health and safety laws as any of the traditional sites to which I referred earlier, and you'll need to treat them as such for compliance purposes. Having said that, the idea of residences being remote workplaces isn't new to either safety or workers' comp laws, and in fact, the Court of Appeal ruled on that very issue as recently as March this year. The case in question involved a lady called Michelle Hill, and it was a workers' compensation case which was commenced by two of her children after she was killed at home by her de facto partner, who was also her work colleague. Now, the partner had some delusional beliefs about how she was carrying out her work, and he then suffered a psychotic break and killed her during a psychotic episode in June 2010. He was charged and found not guilty on the grounds of his mental illness. The Workers' Comp Commission determined that the deceased had died as a result of an injury arising out of and in the course of her employment and ordered payments in favour of her two children. The nominal insurer had to meet the claim because the couple's business had been deregistered by the time the children sought compensation, and it appealed against the decision twice. On both occasions, it lost. The children were compensated appropriately.
Yeah, now that's the case of Workers' Compensation Nominal Insurer and Hill. And that's a 2020 case in the Supreme Court. And I think that case got quite a lot of coverage because of the issues and the findings there. And one of those issues from the Commission was whether the deceased was at work, albeit at home, when she was attacked. And in deciding that, the court looked at whether she suffered an injury arising out of her employment and whether her employment was a substantial and contributing factor to that injury.
That's right. And the time and place at which she passed away was a matter that bore directly on whether her employment was actually a substantial contributing factor to her fatal injury. The question of substantial contributing factor is, of course, fundamental to workers' compensation law and whether or not an injury is compensable under those laws. Now, in this case, the Court of Appeal found that the risk of death by domestic violence or family violence was one that arose from the hostile work environment created by Ms. Hill's partner, which in that case happened to be her home, which is where she worked from. The risk needed to be managed properly and in accordance with both the safety laws and workers' comp legislation. Now, the relevant facts in both of those contexts were that Ms. Hill was on call when she died. Her role required her to be on the premises where the incident occurred. There were work files in her bedroom, which is where she passed away, which suggested that she'd been working there. And her partner's delusions, which motivated the fatal attack, related to the way in which he perceived she was working. Now, it's important here to know that the fact that the attack occurred as a result of mental illness in the home didn't affect the exposure under the workers' comp law. The fact that there was a mental health related risk was just another matter that the employer should have managed. It was not an excuse for non-compliance with the applicable workplace safety laws.
And that's a very unique scenario where it was two partners working at home. Ordinarily, in a broader employment context where an employee is injured while working from home, there may be some peculiar difficulties in proving that there's a casual or causal, I should say, connection between the injury and the employment. However, as this case shows, I think, Erica, and indeed a number of other workers' comp decisions find, that causal connection can quite often be established, particularly where there's a blurring of work hours and workspaces. So as we see the increase and indeed the continuation of remote working environments, which is only going to continue, or indeed even as employers start to require their workers to return back to the office after a period of being at home remotely working, there are invariably going to be some reintegration issues, isn't there, as both employees and employers adjust. Regan, that leads me to the first of three big questions we have for you, and that is, how do you identify if a worker in your organisation may be experiencing family or domestic violence?
Yeah, I believe there are often signs if you're in tune and have some awareness of domestic violence. It may be someone who's been a long-term employee and has had no performance issues to speak of in the past, and all of a sudden they start coming into work late or having a lot more days off than usual. You may notice them checking their phone or being on their phone constantly, which you can imagine, to make arrangements, talking to police, support services or schools. They could be crying or look like they've been crying. They could be quieter than normal, keeping to themselves. They could look physically and emotionally exhausted. Their appearance could be declining, or the opposite, hypervigilant, nervous, anxious, on edge, less ability to regulate their emotions. They could be struggling to focus and concentrate or finish things, maybe less productive. One thing we do know about women experiencing domestic violence is the universal feeling of intense shame, regardless of your background, culture, age, or socioeconomic status. We know that women all report a crippling sense of shame, which is another layer within itself. And I believe it's one of the most significant factors in why women feel they can't often tell anyone even close to them, let alone their workplace and colleagues. And add to that, taking days off and the embarrassment that comes with that, struggling emotionally to act normal at work and hide being visibly upset. You know, this is a really stressful situation. Women need to know that if they're going through this, that it is safe to reach out to their employer. That may mean sharing as little or as much information as they are comfortable with about their situation and not being expected to disclose or prove every detail. But having that space to provide some understanding what is happening for them is critical and should be a given. During that time also, women may be dealing with a physical assault, attending doctor's appointments or the hospital, required to attend the police station to make a statement, which is often a very lengthy process, could be packing up their house to move, staying with relatives or friends, their children may need to change schools, emotional breakdowns and illnesses associated with that high level of stress and trauma, and then supporting and managing their children's emotional responses the same. So there's a lot of high level of stress there, and given the right environment and support, I feel that there will be signs.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very disruptive, it can be a very disruptive time, and I guess, management and workers need to be on, aware of or in tune to those signs.
I think so. Look, once you're looking around at your colleagues or you know from your own experience that those are signs you need to be looking out for, what do you do? What's the next step from an employment law perspective, would you say?
Well, having a well-identified platform which recognises domestic and family violence as a workplace issue is first and foremost the next step. And that usually and invariably should include having procedures and policies in place so that you can manage that process.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Krista. Employers can have such an important role to play in these situations, and the receptiveness of HR management to these issues and having those well-known, well-established and appropriate policies and procedures already in place can really make a difference. Some people or employers have not been exposed or educated about domestic violence, and we can't assume employers can really understand what domestic violence and abuse is. I think it's super important to already have those established, well-identified platforms you're talking about, which recognises that domestic and family violence is a workplace issue. with recognised procedures and policies in place to manage it. I think that's a really good start. If it's okay, I'd like to give an example of a client I had. She was a young Aboriginal woman who was doing a traineeship within New South Wales Health and was going through some serious physical and emotional domestic and family violence on top of caring for a three-year-old son. She told me one day she couldn't hold back her tears at work and started crying, and her manager took her aside and asked her what was wrong. My client told me she had already had a really lovely relationship with her manager and that she was approachable generally. She also said her manager was clearly aware and understood domestic violence and immediately discussed with her the workplace entitlements and the options available to her, such as taking paid leave and flexible work arrangements. A great example of the practical support and flexible work leave in this case is when, due to the breakdown of my client's relationship, one of the factors that was impacted with her childcare options, so much so that her manager advocated on her behalf for her to complete the remainder of her traineeship at 3 days a week versus 5 days. And this was significant and allowed her to now successfully complete that traineeship and gave her time to source other appropriate options for childcare. And since then, she's also been offered a permanent position. When a court orders a woman to appear in court as part of ADVO proceedings, workplaces should support that employer to attend court by granting special leave. You know, most women can't afford just to take time off work unpaid, and often court proceedings are adjourned and delayed for a range of reasons, which can financially impact the victim and potentially risk them losing their job if they do not have a supportive, understanding employer. So, even worse than that, without this support, women may choose not to proceed with safety orders, leaving themselves and their children very vulnerable and at risk. And in the case I've just talked about, the manager, with the employee's permission, my client's permission, actually initiated the contact with our service to refer her for specialist domestic violence support.
What I get from that and some of the practical takeaways is having people in your organisation that know how to start a conversation, can then talk about the workplace entitlements and the options available to their employees, such as taking leave or accessing flexible work arrangements, discussing possible safety measures that you could implement if they feel unsafe in the workplace. You know, that might be blocking calls or blocking emails, changing phone numbers or changing work hours and indeed office location even, and providing the employee with information on where they can get help. I think that's fundamental, and that example that you gave is a really great example of what to do right. Finally, I guess in implementation, how can an employer create a safe space for survivors to disclose, given what you've talked about with that feeling of shame and, you know, the difficulties to speak up on these issues?
Yeah, well, the only reason that we can say that why women all feel this sense of shame is society must make women feel this way or people experiencing domestic violence. So, like we've spoken about, having those policies in place and making sure everyone is aware of them. Also, when you deliver these policies, that could take place to talk about the domestic and family violence policies in inductions. Therefore, it's not seen as a taboo subject. I also think it's really important that it's delivered from an authentic space. I think people could be able to see straight through that if it wasn't taken seriously and there was no commitment behind those policies. You could be putting up posters in the bathrooms encouraging staff to reach out to their manager, HR, if they're experiencing domestic violence. And just such a simple one, but one that isn't always happening, is forming relationships with your staff and showing care and interest in your staff and checking in with your staff. Such an easy thing to do, but like I said, I don't think it's always happening. We can always do better in that. Workplace awareness and involvement around campaigns around domestic and family violence. An example, we have our own domestic family violence campaign, Be the Change, the 16 Days of Activism, which we're in right now, and White Ribbon. So, yeah, if you see your workplace that are actively involved and participating in those events in your communities, it's going to make you feel a sense of belief that your workplace has a genuine commitment in the space of domestic family violence.
So I guess if I could sum up what that looks like in a few key points, it's this. It's for employers understanding your legal obligations as an employer outside of that strict duty of care. There are, of course, award obligations and entitlements for family and domestic violence leave, and making sure that they are available and accessible. develop the workplace policies that we've talked about that support employees experiencing family and domestic violence, and which incorporate those industrial entitlements, but also, as you say, incorporate and run alongside the campaigns that Regan, you've just spoken about, and provide that ongoing education and awareness about this issue. You know, for example, the posters, as you've said, or contact information and support services in the community.
And it's an ongoing process too. This is something that you just can't set and forget. You need to be reviewing your workplace policies, your safety plans, your procedures, and trying your best to evaluate them to make sure that if you need to make changes, you make them, and you make them in a very effective and timely manner. I think you need to create an open workplace culture that really genuinely encourages communication and support to make it easier for employees to raise their concerns. I think it's about empathy.
Regan, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. Thank you. Kingston Reid is proud to partner with Weave Youth and Community Services, which operates in Inner Sydney. Keep up the great work. For anyone experiencing family or domestic violence, you can call 1800 737 732. That's 1-800-RESPECT. For men who have concerns about family and domestic violence, call Men's Line Australia on 1300 789978. Thank you.